This is the place, and this is the time. Here and now, the mystery awaits to break into our experience, to change our minds, to change our lives, to change our ways, to help us see the world and the whole of life in a new light. This is the place. This is the time. Here and now, let us praise the mystery by joining together in song. At the center of our service and at the center of our lives, we take this time to light candles of memory, candles of hope, or because we feel troubled, blessed, conflicted, or simply because we'd like to add a little light to the world. Mystery of many names and mystery beyond all naming. We're here this morning to think about what it might mean to be lost inside our own minds. Lunacy was a common term for many years, and it pointed to the idea that it was the moon that was adversely affecting those who had lost their minds. A Buddhist would ask the question, how could we lose something that we hadn't found? There's a sense in which looking at our minds is like looking at our eyes. We may see a reflection of what the mind looks like in the outside world, but to pretend that we understand completely what's going on inside the human mind would be perhaps the greatest act of hubris. And it is our pride that holds us back from admitting that we are afraid of those who are mental health consumers, because we hold on to the illusion that we are in control. The first step in any 12-step program is to admit that we are powerless. In that admission, something strange happens. Giving up the illusion of control, simply throwing up our hands and giving up, puts us back on solid ground again, puts us back in a place where we might actually be said to have some power. Instead of reacting to the world at large, we would be better off to simply ride the world like we would ride a roller coaster. Yes, there are times when the going is rough, the trail steep, but those are always followed by the rush of the downhill run. And even though we were the ones complaining that things were going too slow, we may be the first to suggest that now things are happening too fast. It would be helpful at those times to remember the advice of any young person who enjoys the roller coaster. At the moment of greatest peril, simply throw up your arms over your head and scream like a banshee. Finally, let us remember that it is culture which determines what is and is not acceptable. And 9 times out of 10, it is culture which defines our sanity or insanity. It's considered sane to be trained to kill an enemy in war and insane to kill an enemy at home. May we all take a good look at our own behavior, loosen up, soften up our critical minds and our critical bodies, get into acceptance both of the strange behavior of others and our own unexplained strange behaviors. Mental illness is curable, but it takes a community of willing participants. Participants who are willing to include everyone and exclude no one. It is love then that finally wins the day. Love that will conquer where fear wants to rule. Give us the peace of heart to see those who are disturbed mentally as the part of us that we have not as yet claimed. We pray this in the name of everything that is holy, and that is precisely everything. Amen. Call me crazy. Got a reading this morning from that pesky old Bible again. It's from the 8th chapter of Luke, the 26th through the 30th verses, the healing of the demon-possessed person. They sailed to the region of Gerasenes, which is across the lake from Galilee. When Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from the town. For a long time, this man had not worn clothes or lived in a house, but had lived in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell on his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High? I beg you, don't torture me. For Jesus had commanded the evil spirit to come out of the man. Many times it had seized him, and though he was chained hand and foot, kept under guard, he had broken the chains, been driven by his demons into solitary places. Jesus finally asked him, "What is your name?" And he answered, "My name is Legion," because many demons had gone into him. Call me crazy. As I look back on my childhood, one memory plagues me. It's the memory of the afternoon of the dog. I remember that when I was young, my family had a medium-sized black mongrel. He was kept chained to a door and unable to move very far in one direction or another. One day, while I was in the kitchen with him, I suddenly grew very angry. In a burst of rage, I grabbed a nearby golf club and began beating the dog furiously. He barked hysterically, but because of the chain, he could not escape. He began to foam at the mouth. As I beat him one by one, his legs collapsed. He kept struggling to rise, but I wouldn't let him. I kept hitting him and hitting him and hitting him. He fell to the ground. He stopped barking. His body writhed in horrible spasms, blood dribbling from his ears and mouth, and after a while, he stopped moving. He was dead. To this day, I do not know why I did it. I try to imagine the evil impulses and anger that must have led to such a crime in my thoughts over the years. I've punished myself over and over again for having committed such a terrible sin against an innocent creature. But there's one thing wrong with this memory. It isn't true. It never happened. So begins Laurie Schiller's book, The Quiet Room, subtitled A Journey Out of the Torment of Madness. She goes on to say that her mother and father and her brothers, Stephen and Mark, all agree they never had such a dog. They did have a family dog. It wasn't medium-sized. It wasn't black. It was a gray schnauzer miniature. It did die, but it died of old age after a very comfortable life with a family that loved it well. Laurie's logical mind tells her that her family is right. There was no medium-sized black dog. There was no brutal murder of that dog. But that's what mental illness can do to you. It can convince you that things happened that never happened. It can convince you that you said things that you never said. It can convince you you heard things that were never spoken. The problem with being logically informed by bystanders that there's a different reality that doesn't agree with your renderings, that simply doesn't matter. What you've been told by your mind is what's true for you. What's true in your mind is true in the world, period. There are parents with mentally ill children who have felt that they are the cause of their children's sickness. There was a belief for years that the upbringing of a child was what led them into mental illness and madness. That myth has been dispelled. However, like the story of the murdered dog, there remains a lingering sense of guilt in the minds of parents of mentally ill children. Surely there was something they could have done that was different, something that might have saved their child. It's only natural for parents to want to save children, but when madness strikes, and strikes is about as good a way to talk about it as any, the people who are affected, like Laurie Schiller, aren't simply normal children with hardly any future, no. They are extraordinary children with bright futures and amazing abilities. Laurie's father, Marvin, was finally out of denial about his lovely daughter, the girl who could do no wrong. That night at the Payne Whitney Clinic in New York City after her second suicide attempt. The first time, Laurie had been apologetic, and it seemed as if the first attempt had simply been an accident. But any semblance of an accident had disappeared in the second attempt. Her parents weren't sure what to expect when they went to see her after this second attempt, but there Laurie was, at least there her body was. The person that looked out from Laurie's eyes didn't seem to be their daughter. She wasn't apologetic about the second attempt. She seemed preoccupied as her parents tried to comfort her. Then she turned to her daddy and she said, I know you're not going to believe this, Daddy, but I can fly. Her father was taken back. The hairs on his arms stood up, and he said, What? I can fly, Daddy. Really, I can fly. She spoke in a soft voice and was very focused. She wasn't boasting, but found this sudden ability rather unbelievable. Her father turned to her and said, Then why don't you show us, honey? She walked to the sofa on the other side of the visiting room and climbed up on it. She spread her arms and looked down at her feet and then at the floor. It isn't high enough, she said. If you take me to the window over there, I'll show you. I'll show you, Daddy, I can fly. Needless to say, her father didn't take her to the window, and he was sure if she had found an open window, she would have jumped out. Swan dived to the street below, believing all the time that she was flying. There's a story that's told of a semi-truck driver who gets his truck stuck under an overpass. Trailer just wouldn't go through. He got out, and he noticed that he was right beside an insane asylum. And then he saw someone standing behind the fence, and that person said, Looks like you could use some help. Well, he took his hat off and kind of smiled and said, Yeah, I could use some help. Well, the person behind the fence said, Well, you know, all you have to do is let out half the air in all your tires. He got back in the truck and pulled through the underpass, got out and went over, and he said, Hey, I really appreciate it, but I want to know, what are you doing in there? And the man sort of looked at him and said, You know, just because I'm crazy doesn't mean I'm stupid. What Lori Schiller wanted more than anything else was to return home and be the smart, normal person that she was before her madness came upon her. She was sick to death of hearing herself referred to as a patient, as someone who is mentally ill, not in contact with reality. She felt, as many patients who are locked up with mental problems, that they are just being locked up, by being separated from the rest of the society, by being told over and over again that their reality, the reality of the screaming, accusatory voices, was not real. They feel as if the doctors and nurses and all the health professionals are against them. And it's easy for me to see that if I was in that same situation, the first thing on my mind would be a release from the hospital with a dominant cultural position on mental illness was reinforced with every breath I took. And yet, these men, women, and children who suffer from mental illness, even though they do not wish to be labeled medicated and essentially incarcerated, albeit in a hospital, these same men, women, and children suffer from rages that can be lethal at times, even to those who wish to help them. Not that all those who suffer from depression disorders are violent. They aren't, but some can be. Perfect example was this Labor Day weekend when a doctor got a call from a young man in a rage. The psychiatrist took his Sunday, which he usually reserved for his family activities, went to see this enraged individual and was murdered by him. What can one say about that? The closest I've ever come to this is in my lifeguard training when I was in high school. I was told by my instructors, if you wish to help a drowning person, do not swim directly up to them, because all they want to do is get a hold of someone and be reassured that they're not going to drown, and in essence, they drown both of you. What would the world's major religions be like if today's diagnostic tools were used on the prophets and seers who arose in our world? How effective would Jesus have been if he had been from a rich Jewish family that could have afforded not only a psychiatrist, but a sanatorium where his delusions of grandeur and his megalomania could have been brought under control by psychotropic drugs that would leave him drooling with muscle spasms, unable to concentrate on the Torah, and ineffective with his disciples? The world is not a perfect place. That's probably the understatement of the century. As a matter of fact, the values of the world and the values of spiritual life are at loggerheads. If a person walks down the street naked in this country, they will be arrested and taken to a hospital. But if that same person were to walk naked down the street in India, down the street in Bombay, smiling, not causing anybody any trouble, that person would be looked upon as a holy person. For in Indian society, it is believed that if one is able to peaceably transcend the constraints of society, then it would follow that one was following a law greater than the law of humankind. I have a dear friend who is a judge in the appellate court system in Denver, Colorado, Sandy Rothman. When she grew up in a small town in New England, once a year, a woman by the name of Helen would run down the street naked. Whenever the neighbors saw her, they just simply called her husband, and he went and picked her up. And that was that. We have become a society of strangers, no longer able to maintain families or extended families. We have relegated the care of those who are not like the rest of us to policemen and doctors. We have specialized in this industrial age, and specialization has led us to the point where there's lots of information, but not a whole lot of wisdom. The National Alliance on Mental Health, NAMI, recently finished a Grading the States report. It's a report on our nation's mental health care system. This country, the USA, gets a D. That's not a passing grade in graduate school. Certainly leaves a lot to be desired for this country. Dr. Suzanne Vogel-Skiblia, president of the board of NAMI, in her board report, says, "There is nothing more agreeable in life than to make peace with the establishment, and nothing more corrupting." Dr. Vogel-Skiblia goes on in report to say, "It is crucial not to accept less because of our now collegial relationship with those in power. We must cultivate and maintain positive contacts, but not become co-opted. Walking this thin line is difficult." And she can say this even though for the first time in 30 years, three decades, the present administration has targeted mental health budgets to be cut. It is said that 15-20% of the world's population suffers from depression, and that can run the gamut from major depression, bipolar disorders, adolescent depression, and schizophrenia. Another alarming statistic is in a 2005 Harvard study, which states that 25% of the U.S. population is in need of mental health care. That's 75 million people nationwide, 6 million in Texas, and 200,000 in Austin alone. That's a third of the population, approximately, of this city. When your bulletins were passed out to you this morning, some of you got something special. Well, those who got a red star in the front of their church bulletin, please raise your hand. Keep your hands up. That would mean within this population here this morning, this many people would be in need of some mental health care. You can put your hands down. We all know you're crazy. Now add to that the number of people, indirectly or directly, that would be affected by these people's mental health problems, and you get to see not only the enormity of the challenge, but the breadth and depth of what ostensibly is a very common problem. There's new research from the New England Journal of Medicine that suggests that medicinal treatment for these disorders works. These medicines work to the point that not only do symptoms disappear, but often there is complete remission. Trying simply one antidepressant and not getting results does not mean that antidepressants do not work. 33% of those who try an antidepressant and it doesn't work would be cured to the point of no symptoms if they just add one other medication. 25% of those who try antidepressants and it doesn't work would be cured of symptoms if they would just switch to another antidepressant. But how does a society get to the point where there's no longer a stigmatization against those in society who are called mental health consumers? That's how they're called nowadays, mental health consumers. How do we get to the point where we realize that mental health disorders are the most hidden and crippling of our national diseases? People who look normal and generally act normal are suffering, and it's ridiculous to suggest that they should simply buck up and face reality. Their reality is not the same as the average person's, and it's time to stop placing blame, time to realize that the chemistry of our brains is highly sophisticated, so much so that we're still in the dark ages. We look back on those pictures of those primitive people knocking holes in people's heads, And we practice our social Darwinism, saying, oh, how primitive those people were. Well, let me tell you, in 100 years, people are going to be looking back on us. The most compelling story I read in these 2 weeks of readings is from Dr. Beth Baxter, a practicing psychiatrist in Tennessee. She tells the story of her mental illness. She was one sharp cookie. In college, she won every degree and every honor, and by the time she graduated, she had a full scholarship to medical school. She went to medical school in the morning, and she saw her psychiatrist in the afternoon because she was receiving messages from her television, messages from popular songs on the radio, and events in her environment. Finally, one afternoon, she found herself standing in her apartment after having cut with a broken glass through her neck, holding both carotid arteries pulsating in her hands. It was at that point that she knew she needed some help. With the help of psychiatrists and antidepressants and her family and friends, she's returned to society, not as a deficient member of that society who is only able to put objects in a box on an assembly line, but as a fully functioning psychiatrist. As Dr. Baxter put it, my primary goal through all of this is to give back some of what I have been given, to inspire other persons with seriously mental illnesses to follow their dreams. In conclusion, let me say this. My primary goal in this sermon, put this national problem, this statewide problem, and this Austin problem right in front of us so we can take a good look at it. I certainly hope that no one thinks I'm in any way making fun or poking fun at mental illness when I title my sermon, Call Me Crazy. For my only desire is that those on the fringes of society be drawn into the bosom of that same society, brought back into the center, not so that we may laugh at them, but brought into the center so that when laughing occurs, they are standing there with us, not the butt of our unconscious and cruel societal humor, but as a part of life, a part of the living. For when we all laugh together, laughter becomes healing instead of a social distancing tool. There is a sense in which we can all say, there but by the grace of God go I. When Jesus asked the demoniac what his name was, and he answered, Legion, we can all identify with the fact that there are times in our hectic lives, schedules, and considering the many hats we wear every day, when we feel as if there must be surely a multitude inside of us. In the face of all we know today about the brain and its disorders, let us stop pretending that deep within each of us there is not tangled skeins. Let us stop pretending that we never doubt ourselves or have thoughts about our own self-destruction. Let us finally realize that what separates us from those who are mentally ill is our fear that their problems are perhaps a little too close to home, our home. To truly and finally be acknowledged, let us let down our guard, embrace our sisters and brothers who are mental health consumers, and bring them back into the fold of our loving trust.